From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When a group of doctors issued a warning about the state's air pollution last month, they stated their concerns in no uncertain terms. Utah's air, they said, which includes week-long inversions, is already causing irreparable harm, even death to some residents. And they said there has to be drastic change if leaders are going to begin to reverse the danger. If you look at the history, the culture, the economy of the state, drastic is a good word for one of the group's proposals. They're recommending a moratorium on all coal-fired power plants. But here's a fact the doctors, groups, and other environmental advocates are up against. Coal powers nearly 95% of the state's energy. So today in the program, we're talking about how the concerns over the health effects of coal are competing with the realities of an increasing demand for energy. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Last month, a group of doctors had a pretty clear warning for Utah leaders and residents about the state's bad air. Air pollution, they said, is causing irreparable harm to people's health, kills nearly 1,000 people a year, and the group called for drastic change in policy and behavior. Among the recommendations is a moratorium on new coal-fired power plants in the state. There are a number of plants in various stages of development in the state and region, including plans to expand some of the plants already online. But in Utah, coal is big business, and it's a big part of the state's history and culture as well. Don't forget, the state rock is, you guessed it, coal. Well, today in the program, we're talking about the economics, the politics, and the health effects of coal. We invite you to join the conversation. 585-WEST is the number, 585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us first on the program is Dr. Brian Mensch, a physician at LDS Hospital, former instructor of anesthesia at Harvard Medical School, along with several other physicians. Dr. Mensch formed the group I mentioned before, the Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment. And Dr. Mensch, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us here in the studio is Tim Wagner, the director of the Utah Smart Energy Campaign for the Utah Sierra Club. And Tim, welcome to you.
Thank you, Doug.
Well, let me start, first of all, I guess, with the most sort of crucial question, Dr. Mensch, and that is, what are the effects of, in particular, if, I guess if you can parse them out, of coal-fired plants on the health of the public in Utah?
Well, last time we talked about the health effects of air pollution in general, and a remarkable study was done in 2003 in the northeastern part of the United States when a power outage shut down 100 coal-fired power plants in the area. Somebody had the stroke of genius to go out and measure the air quality during this shutdown, and they found that 24 hours after the shutdown, air measurements taken hundreds of miles from the source of the air pollution, hundreds of miles from these coal power plants, showed within that short amount of time a reduction of 90% of sulfur dioxide, 70% reduction in particulate matter, and a 50% reduction in ground ozone level. Now, that just gives you a little bit of a feeling for the impact on regional air quality that coal-fired power plants can have. Now, the West doesn't have as much of a concentration as the eastern part of the United States does, but that still is illustrative of what a significant contribution coal power plants have to our air pollution. We know that coal is one of the most impure, if not the most impure, of all the fossil fuels. And there are 55 different contaminants within coal that are known to cause problems with children's brain development and physical development. 24 of those compounds are either known to be or likely to be human carcinogens, things like arsenic, lead, cadmium, and then radionuclides. So we know that those kinds of things, as in impurities in coal, are released during the coal combustion phase, and then we know they're also concentrated in the post-combustion residue. So not only do coal-fired power plants contribute significantly to the overall background air pollution levels in the entire West, but they have some particular toxic effects given these impurities that significantly impact the health of children, but the rest of the population as well.
I want to talk about some of those particulars. Let me ask you, Tim Wagner, when you know, when people think of air pollution, I'm not sure coal comes to mind first. There aren't, you know, along the Wasatch Front, you don't see, at least I'm not thinking offhand of, you know, smokestacks bellowing, you know, pollution into the air. Most people think of, you know, cars as the bigger part of that. Where does that – how do you figure the equation in terms of all of that?
Yeah, you're exactly right, Doug. I think it's estimated right now that about 65% of the major sources of pollutants in along the Wasatch Front does come from transportation sources. And that rest of that 35% or so comes from industry. A portion of that does come from burning coal. And so certainly the transportation issue is a big part of the problem along the Wasatch Front. But when we're looking at the overall picture and the overall impacts from to health, and particularly dealing with particulate matter, which coal, burning coal, is a major source of particulate matter, and also nitrogen oxide, we just can't ignore this. It's a major component. And we have a major facility just about 80 miles upwind of the Wasatch Front, the Intermountain Power Plant. And, of course, sometimes it doesn't affect us because it just depends on prevailing winds. But clearly it is more in line to affect a lot of people in the Utah County area, where we have approximately 500,000 people that live. It's further directly in line with the prevailing winds that come off of the western part of the state where that particular plant is located. So it still is a big issue. It's really a big issue for citizens in Sevier County, where they're looking at a major sizable coal plant being built right in the midst of their valley, right within a mile and a half of 170-some homes. This is really a major issue. And so, yeah, I think we cannot discount it. We certainly have to look at the transportation issue, and I think Brian and the rest of the physicians are doing a really bang-up job in terms of trying to come up with some reasonable things that people can do, that we as a society and our government can do to address the larger transportation problem. But coal is certainly a mix of the bigger problem.
You know, Dr. Mitch, when you talk about some of the particular concerns, one is the effect on mercury. And you've said some kind of compelling things in terms of the connection between autism rates and mercury, which is an important component in terms of the effects of coal.
Well, the relationship between mercury and autism is certainly controversial in the medical community. There are some studies that suggest that the circumstantial evidence implicating mercury is very strong, and there are some studies that suggest that the relationship may not be strong at all. So, to be fair, it's still significant controversy within the medical community. But the EPA has identified mercury as the most toxic component of air pollution. And the reason for that is it's indisputably a potent neurotoxin. In fact, that's been identified as long ago as the mid-1800s, when the term Mad Hatter became a term that referred to workers who were forming hats, used mercury in that process, and their exposure to the mercury caused neurobehavioral disorders that they were then given the term Mad Hatters. In the 1930s, there was a disease called Pink's disease, or acrodynia, that eventually probably affected, in terms of fatalities, had a fatality rate of about 30%. And it turned out the source was mercury was being used in teething compounds for children. Mercury was then added to vaccines, which created a real public controversy as to whether or not that was appropriate. And a lot of countries preceded the United States in eliminating mercury from vaccines, probably by 10 or 15 years. In fact, the health department in Russia took mercury out of their vaccines probably 15 to 16 years before the United States did. So mercury as a neurotoxin has been recognized for decades, if not longer than that. And mercury is a significant contaminant of coal. And the problem with mercury is that mercury is emitted virtually in every phase of the coal cycle. Mercury is released in the pre-combustion phase. it is released up the smokestack during the combustion phase. And then in the post-combustion residue, you have this leftover mercury. So all three of those components of the coal cycle create problems in terms of adding mercury to the environment.
Seems to be a sense of urgency here going on, certainly with the doctors' groups and others. Tim Wagner, a plan by there are electric utilities now who are proposing new coal-fired plants, and they're in the sort of process of preparing that, dealing with local communities. What do you understand what's in the works here in terms of companies sort of laying the groundwork for some of these plants?
Are you talking specifically Utah?
Yes.
Yeah. For example, yes, the Intermountain Power Plant project, for example, that's a large generating station, coal-fired generating station out near Delta. It produces about 1,700 megawatts of power. The majority of that, about 75% of it, goes to Southern California right now, and then the rest goes to various cities throughout Utah. They have proposed, have been proposing now for about 5 years, another 950 megawatt plant at the same location, and that would be a traditional pulverized coal plant, and that would. The major buyers of that plant originally were slated to be the cities of Southern California, like L.A., Pasadena, and Riverside. And those cities have all opted out of that plant, have all opted out except for Glendale. It is opted to stay in for a small portion of the power from that project. But the rest of the plant's power, the proposed plant's power, is proposed to be taken up by a third by Rocky Mountain Power here in Utah. About 50% of it would go to the Utah Association of Municipal Power Systems, or UAMPS, which makes up about 50 cities throughout Utah, Idaho, Nevada, Oregon, Northern California. And then about 100 megawatts of that plant is proposed to go to the Southern Nevada Water Authority, which would be utilized to power their pumps for this big water project they're proposing to pump water out of the Great Basin in the West Desert areas. One of the other projects, like I mentioned before, is the 270 megawatt power project in Sevier County, and that would be located in a small valley, much smaller than Cache Valley, and where about 18,000 people currently live. That project has in the permitting stage, has been permitted, but that I should mention that project and the IPP plant, both the permits, our organization has appealed. Along with the Grand Canyon Trust, and those appeals will be heard later this fall by the Division of Air Quality Board.
Dr. Minch, this is a particular concern for you. You've said that in an op-ed piece in the Tribune that right now some of these companies are attempting to sign up municipalities through Utah, you know, to make these commitments. So this is a particular concern for you.
Well, we're concerned that the Utah municipalities that have been approached will be obligating themselves to financially support these coal power projects for the next five decades or more. It seems almost inconceivable that within the next five decades, we won't have substantially improved our ability to derive a sufficient amount of energy from renewable sources and so forth. The very day that these coal power plants get built, they will be technological dinosaurs. And so you need to look at the fact that if they do get built, they will drain money and resources away from opportunities that we could have had to seriously pursue and develop and magnify our renewable energy options.
We should mention that we contacted Rocky Mountain Power, which provides, I think, some 80% of energy to this state. Earlier this week, we contacted them. We invited them to take part in today's discussion. Spokesman Dave Eskelson said that the media had not been adequately covering their side of the story, that he looked forward to participating. But in following up yesterday, we were told they wouldn't, in fact, join us. When pushed for a reason, Mr. Eskelson said simply, "We are unable to participate." So I'm not sure why, but they will not be joining us today. Brian Mensch is with us, a physician at LDS Hospital, formed the group Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment. Tim Wagner with us, director of the Utah Smart Energy Campaign for the Utah Sierra Club. We invite you to join us. 585 West is the number, 585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on FM 90. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here's a fact that doctors' groups and other environmental advocates concerned about the pollution generated by coal are up against. Coal powers nearly 95% of the state's energy, and there's no indication that growth in Utah is slowing anytime soon. So today in the program, we're talking about how the concerns about the health effects of coal are competing with the realities of an increasing demand for energy. 585 West is the number to join the conversation, 585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We're going to have with us here in a moment an advocate for the Americans for Balanced Energy Choices here in just a moment. No, it looks like we do have him, in fact. Joe Lucas, the executive director of Americans for Balanced Energy Choices. It's a nonprofit organization based in Virginia. It advocates for coal-based electricity. In the 1990s, Mr. Lucas was with the U.S. Department of Energy. During that time, served as an assistant to the Secretary of Energy, and he's joining us now from his office in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And Joe Lucas, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. I didn't want to, get in trouble for inflating my resume. I was not an assistant secretary for energy. I was assistant to
the secretary of energy. I misread
that.
Forgive me.
In the secretary's office. So there's a distinction that folks in D.C. would know the difference thereof.
Okay, good. I misread that. Sorry. Welcome. Thanks very much for being with us. I want to start by asking you, first of all, to respond to something said by Brian Mensch earlier in the program, just before the break, in fact, that the minute a coal-fired plant goes online, it in effect becomes a technological dinosaur, that in many ways its technology is already obsolete. And I wanted you to begin by responding to that assertion.
Well, in part, I would have to say that I agree with that, because technology is always evolving. And what we thought of as clean coal technology, if you would, 30 years ago, is something that's become, you know, it's the common everyday part. And so to some degree, clean coal technology is like medical technology. It's always evolving. But it is a little bit different. Sometimes I use the car as an analogy. When I first got my license in the late 70s, I could change the oil in my car because I could open up the hood and I understood what was underneath the hood, and it was very simple. Today, because of the environmental controls that are on cars, you open up your car, and you almost have to be a PhD, it seems like, to even know how to change your oil or to check your oil. Because our engines are so much more complex today than they were in the late 70s because of the advent of technology. But where one is still not driving a 1970s car that has been retrofitted with all the new technologies that are underneath the hood of a new car in an automobile, that's essentially what happens with power plants. As power plants are built, and this has certainly been the case for the last 30 years, developers of power plants have left additional space at the physical plant so that additional environmental controls can be added onto these power plants. So the power plants that were built in the 70s are actually about 70% cleaner on average than they were when they were built. Now, by the same token, a new power plant that's built today is even cleaner than the existing plants that are out there. And so technology is always evolving, but we're always able to add these new technologies to existing plants that do make them more efficient in producing energy with less pollution.
How do you react, Joe Lucas, to the call from this particular group anyway for a moratorium on new coal-fired energy plants in this region? Is that realistic? Is that reasonable?
Well, I think it's the absolute wrong approach to take for two reasons. Number one, our energy demand in this country is growing, and our energy demand around the world is growing. Now, that's not to say that we're not becoming more energy efficient. It's just we are becoming more energy efficient. We're just using more energy. I use the analogy all the time that when I grew up in a house in rural Kentucky, we had five people in the house and we had one television. Today, I live in a house by myself and I have five televisions. And I really don't think anybody could have predicted or would have predicted 30 years ago that the consumer electronics craze would take over the way that it has. And that even though we have become more efficient and our appliances are more energy efficient, we're still using more energy. And that's the same here in the United States, and it's certainly the same around the world. And so as we have to grow demand to meet or grow supply to meet that demand, we look at the available resources that are out there. And coal here in the United States is domestically abundant. It's affordable. And because of the use of technology, it is becoming more and more environmentally compatible every day. And I believe that if we have moratoriums, that not only will we do some of the things that we always talk about, such as we will, you know, put reliability at risk, we'll pay higher prices, we also sort of close off the door to the development of the new technologies. That each new power plant that is built today is one step further, or one step closer, if you would, to the eventual goal of power plants that produce energy with no emissions at all, and that would include greenhouse gases. And so we have to continue to push the envelope on technology. And the best way to do that is to keep building new advanced clean coal technologies that are out there that are continuing to perfect these technologies, drive down the cost of deploying these technologies, and ensure that these technologies get spread not only through the domestic market, but also around the world.
How important, Mr. Lucas, is coal to the American economy and to its energy needs?
Well, it's critically important. First off, let's deal with the energy mix. First off, I'm very, as you can tell, optimistic about coal. But coal's not perfect, and neither is any other energy resource. Here in this country, every time we've tried to pick a winner or a loser, we always pick wrong. In the early 1970s, we said that nuclear power would be too cheap to meter, and we were wrong. In the late 70s, we said, well, that experiment with nuclear didn't work out too well. Let's push coal. And so we went on this jag of building coal plants whenever we could and wherever we could. And we overbuilt in the 70s, in the early 70s on coal. And because of concerns about acid rain and others, we backed off of coal. And in the 90s, we got on this sort of kick to build natural gas. The fact is we shouldn't put any of our all of our eggs in any one basket. We do need a domestic energy portfolio that is diverse, that allows for emerging energy resources like renewables to come on board and to play a role. So this is not just about shifting to coal or putting too much emphasis on coal, but allowing coal to be a part of a balanced energy portfolio. How important is that? Well, America has more energy in the form of coal than Saudi Arabia or even the entire Middle East has in the form of oil. And because of the fact that we have it here, it is affordable, it does create jobs, it holds down costs for people who are paying energy bills. We did some research, just some analysis using existing government data, and we find that about 10% of the American population is spending almost 50% of their total household income budget to cover energy-related expenditures. So anytime you hear somebody say that the problem with U.S. energy policy is we need to raise the price so that people have to pay more and use less, that's losing sight of the fact that there are many people already struggling right now to cover the energy costs that they have. And so coal is tremendously important, not only to our economy, it creates jobs, not only in the mining sector or in the utility sector, transportation sector, but because we have traditional low-cost energy, we have manufacturing jobs that are here in the United States. So it's critically important to our economy. It's critically important to our national security. But again, I just want to be clear that we're not talking about just coal. We're talking about coal as it fits into an entire balanced energy portfolio.
Joe Lucas is with us. He's the executive director of Americans for Balanced Energy Choices. 585 West is the number to join us, 585-9378. Let's give Brian Minch and Tim Wagner a chance to react to the idea that, you know, the coal industry is developing technologies to make it a cleaner industry.
Brian Minch? Well, I have to tell you how much I love the term balanced energy. If half of my house is on fire, is my house balanced? If, as a physician, I'm only killing half of my patients, am I a balanced physician? We can estimate from the volume of sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide compounds released from even these more upgraded coal plants that each one of these typical 1,000-megawatt coal plants will produce enough pollution that will cause somewhere between 20 and 50 deaths per year, each plant. Nationwide, we can estimate from the volume of pollution that approximately 22,000 people in this country will die premature deaths because of the air pollution caused by coal. Now, the idea that we have all these coal reserves and that we're the Saudi Arabia of the world in terms of coal reserves, to me, that makes about as much sense as saying there is an open field next door to my house where tobacco is growing. I'd hate to see that tobacco go to waste. I better smoke it. Because we have these coal reserves doesn't mean they're good for us, doesn't mean they're good for the planet, and doesn't mean that there aren't significant public health consequences to our use of it.
But Tim Wagner, why not concede the realities of coal as an economic factor of not just Utah but in the country and say, well, let's work with this industry to see what we can do. I mean, 95% of the state's energy is fueled by coal. So why not concede that reality and deal with that as opposed to talking about moratoriums and these kinds of things?
Well, as Brian pointed out earlier, when we talk about the investment that is needed to build some of these facilities, that takes a lot of capital. Just for example, the IPP plant alone, the 950-megawatt proposed plant, that's a $2.6 billion investment. If we were to take that $2.6 million and instead invest it in just in wind turbines, we could put up somewhere in the range of about 11,000 wind turbines across the state of Utah, which would have a tremendous economic impact rurally, much more so than that one particular generating station from IPP. And I want to respond to one of the things that Mr. Lucas said, partly, you know, he's certainly right on that our energy demand is going up dramatically in this country. But that doesn't mean that we cannot address some of that through tremendous efficiency opportunities, which right now it's estimated that we waste about 30% of the electricity generated in this country. That's a tremendous amount of energy that just basically goes out the stack that we could capture, that we could utilize to meet some of this new demand if we just got smart about this. But the fact also remains that if we look at the 150 new proposed coal plants across the country, we're looking at a total investment of somewhere in the range of about $300 billion. If that $300 billion was instead invested in both efficiency and renewable sources, i.e. wind, solar, geothermal, biomass, we could really go a long ways in meeting future growth and demand for the next 30 to 40 years without building any more coal plants. And we wouldn't have the tremendous health impacts and tremendous cost of trying to capture all that CO2 that we need to do. So, you know, you're really almost comparing apples to oranges in many ways. I think Brian's metaphor of the tobacco field is probably one of the best I've heard in terms of, and I hear this all the time, we have this resource, let's use it, it's cheap. Well, it's not cheap. It's not cheap when you consider all the environmental and health impacts that we are incurring. And if I could, I would just respond, you know, when we talk about these clean coal projects, I'm going to read some brief stats on just the emissions coming from the Sevier County power plant that has been permitted by DEQ, by the Division of Air Quality. That one plant in 1 year would emit 177 tons of particulate matter, 234 tons of sulfur dioxide, 1,066 tons of nitrogen oxide, 1,278 tons of carbon monoxide, 53 tons of VOCs, which would include all kinds of ozone and toxin components, and then 16 tons of other hazardous air pollutants, which include mercury as well. And that doesn't, and then also on top of that is about 1.2 million tons of CO2 annually. That's just that one small facility, 270 megawatts. So I'm sorry, but when we're talking about clean coal and all these plants that are being proposed across the country, they're not clean in my mind. They really aren't.
585 West is the number to join the conversation, 585-9378. Let's take a few calls. Danny is with us calling from Salt Lake City. Danny, welcome.
Hey, thanks. How are y'all?
Fine, thanks.
You know, it's no surprise that Rocky Mountain Power doesn't want to talk about it, you know, but it's predictable what they're going to say. They're going to say, look, we can't bet on a maybe. We got to go with what we got right here now, or we're going to, you know, be in a terrible shape later, and that will always be the argument. You know, we got to just use what we got right now, or else. And the guy who called in from Florida, you know, his insinuation is that as we build more coal-fired plants, that they're going to get better and better and better, and that the industry itself is always going to be striving, you know, for the cleanest coal it can be. But that's, for the past 8 years, they've all been whining that they don't want to upgrade the plants that they have. You know, the industry has never, ever done it on its own. It's always had to get kicked in the butt by the government to do whatever it was going to do. And they've had 8 years of Bush who said, do whatever you want, you know. They're not going to do it on their own. They're only going to do it if we make them do it.
Okay. Danny, glad you called.
Hey, thanks.
Thanks. 585 West, the number to join us. Dr. Minch, you wanted to respond?
Well, to amplify the point that the caller just made, there has been tested technology to capture mercury in the emission stacks of coal-fired power plants that has been proven to be effective in municipal incinerators probably for the last 10 years. No mercury capture technology, at least as of a year ago, has been applied to any coal power plant in this country because they didn't have to. That tells you, one, what their priority is, and two, that they can claim that we have all this great technology, that we're improving our position and so forth. But here's a very good example of where the technology exists. Unless they are forced to do it, they don't do it. And yet the technology that I just described is called activated carbon injection, has been estimated to probably add only about between $8 and $10 a year to the average electrical consumer. And yet even though it's that small, they still have not opted to use it, even though it can be shown to be 90 to 95% effective in capturing mercury from emission stacks.
585 West, the number to join the conversation, 585-9378. Brian Minch is with us. He is with Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment. Tim Wagner, the director of the Utah Smart Energy Campaign with the Utah Sierra Club. 585 West, again the number, our email address, radio west@kuer.org. Let me remind you that we contacted Rocky Mountain Power earlier this week and invited them to take part in today's discussion. We were told yesterday that Rocky Mountain Power is unable to participate. They didn't give us a specific reason. We're going to take a break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on FM 90. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When a group of doctors issued a warning about the state's air pollution last month, they stated their concerns in no uncertain terms, and they said there had to be drastic change if state leaders are going to reverse or begin to reverse the danger. If you look at the history, the culture, the economy of the state, drastic is a pretty good word for one of the group's proposals. They're recommending a moratorium on all coal-fired power plants. Today in the program, we're talking about how the concerns about the health effects of coal are competing with the realities of an increasing demand for energy. We invite you to join us. 585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuwr.org. Joining us now on the program is Jonah Owen Lamb. He is a reporter, a staff writer for the Salt Lake City Weekly. Jonah's story about a dispute in Sevier County over a proposed 270-megawatt coal-fired power plant was the cover story for the magazine last week. That's the May 3rd issue of the City Weekly. And Jonah, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
How are you doing?
I wanted to there's interesting dynamics in your story because you talk about beyond just the health effects, you talk about sort of the social dynamics. And in the piece itself, you call this a classic tale of colonial exploitation. Talk about what you mean by that.
Well, what I mean by that is I think if you take the example of like Walmart spreading across the country, I think that's a good way to look at it because that's kind of a story people are aware of. You know, Walmart comes in. They say, look, we're going to offer you all this good stuff. And, you know, it's debatable on how much the locals actually get from this. So, for instance, in Sevier County, this big company comes in, which is the similar thing with SEFCO Mine. They're the biggest mine, I think, for coal in the state. They come in. They say, look, we're going to give you jobs. We're going to give you tax dollars. And the environmental impacts are going to be limited. And so, you know, most of the time, rural counties seem to think this is a good idea. And I think that the trade-off is really a lot less fair than it appears. For instance, in the long run, the tax dollars, which is a lot of money. I mean, I think Sevier County is estimated to get $600 million a year of taxes.
Right.
And that's great and all, but then you think it locks them into a relationship with this power plant. 20 years down the line, which, you know, seems like a long time and all, but that plant has been reduced in value by massive amounts. For instance, in Millard County, originally the IPP plant, 90% of tax dollars for about the last 20 years came from the plant. Well, 20 years later, that's almost been cut in half, and they've expanded all of these services, and they've reduced property taxes. So people are all, you know, sounds great, right? Mm-hmm. But now they're stuck in this conundrum. Well, the only way they can get that money they've lost back is by supporting the new part of the plant, which isn't going to be good for their health or the environment or all these other things.
You know, it's interesting. You talk about how Sevier County, population of about 18,000 people, you talk about what it's doing to the community. You say that it's really split the community. It's become impolite in the region to really talk about the power plant during dinner because it's such an area, I guess, of contention in that region.
Well, I think that's true, definitely, and I think also from my reporting down there. Initially, you know, let's say 5 years ago, the idea of a power plant and kind of consciousness about global warming and all these things weren't really that present. And so I think in a lot of ways, this has kind of entered the local consciousness and has become a lot realer for people. And that's kind of, on one hand, changed a lot of how people are looking at this plant. But also, since there's a lot of farmers down there, it's really come down to much more kind of local impacts. Like the water impact might be huge, and a lot of these farmers depend on the aquifer-fed water in the county. So it's become personal. You know, some farmers who farm together right next to each other, you know, kind of used to be close friends, not quite close friends anymore.
Yeah.
So it's a really contentious thing. It's hard to say how many people are supporting the plant, how many are not. I mean, that's one of those things you can't really quantify. But they did elect a county commissioner purely on an anti-plant platform, which I think shows that there's
some movement,
some support to fight this plant.
It's interesting also you talk about how, you know, this is a, for the most part, I guess, or at least for a large part, an agricultural community. And the struggle is whether this particular land, you know, remains farmland or becomes something else entirely. Seems like the whole sense of the community, the identity of the community in some ways is kind of at stake. Is that overstating it?
I don't know. I don't know if that's exactly the way it is. I mean, to me, on one level, you know, you look at farming across the country and how small farmers are kind of losing their foothold economically. So all the farmers I spoke to, that's definitely a factor in what's going on down there. But the question of some people seem to want, you know, they want a rail line to come in there eventually. You know, they want to really turn it into something else than what it is. And so I think that there is a question of whether, you know, do you really need these things? Are these things that the county doesn't, according to everyone I spoke to, really isn't hurting economically? I mean, it's not as good as, you know, Salt Lake County or something, but, you know, whether or not all these things are really needed and whether or not it's going to totally change the feeling and the culture of the county is something can't really be predicted. Mm.
Dr. Mintz, you wanted to say?
Well, one of the things that shouldn't be overlooked here in this issue is how water-intensive coal-fired power plants are.
Mm-hmm.
We estimate that the four proposed coal power plants for the state of Utah will use as much water as a municipality of 1 million people. Nationwide, 46% of all the water consumed, all the fresh water consumed, is consumed by the coal power industry. That is more than agriculture and municipalities combined. So with Utah being obviously a very dry state, and with climate change, Utah will be destined to become hotter and drier. To commit that much water resources to this kind of an antiquated electrical resource, to me, is just astonishingly short-sighted. And this community that that Jonah has highlighted illustrates very much what that trade-off may be. Those farmers in the area may, in fact, lose the water that sustains their agriculture if they commit that much water to this new coal power plant. But that's a trade-off that is being played over and over throughout the West, and that will become a much more serious issue than it is now 20, 30 years down the road.
One of the things, Tim Wagner, that you say, you're quoted in Jonah's story, is that this is in fact part of a kind of a national trend. Jonah says there are something like 12 new coal-fired plants being proposed just in the Rocky Mountain region. What are you seeing in terms of the trend? And this is the thing that was compelling about what you said in Jonah's story about the fact that people are sort of ramping up because they know that the Bush administration is, you know, soon at an end, and so they're struggling to get sort of under the Bush administration. Talk about that, if you will.
Yeah, there is no doubt that there has been a big push by the administration and the coal industry, fossil fuel industry in general, just to really expand operations as much as possible, as long as they have a fairly regulatory friendly administration in the White House. That is coming to an end. The big issue in dealing with the politics behind a lot of these coal plants is the fact of global warming and CO2 emissions and how we are now grappling with that issue. A lot of these plants that are being proposed, out of the 150 being proposed across the country, less than 30 are being proposed for what's actually called clean coal or gasification, where they can actually capture the CO2 and possibly store it. The rest of those projects are not of that type of design, which means that probably a lot of those proposed projects are in hopes of sneaking in under the wire and trying to escape some of the regulations that most people are, say, for certain are coming down the pike from Congress to control greenhouse gas emissions. But clearly, that I don't think that's going to happen. And Congress has strongly indicated that they're not going to allow these plants to be grandfathered in. That we've got to get a handle on this CO2 issue completely. So, you know, when we look at the four plants being proposed in Utah, I mean that could add up to an additional 14 million tons of CO2 to the state's greenhouse gas footprint already, which is around 70 million tons annually. So as a member who sits on the Blue Ribbon Advisory Council for the governor on climate change, that's not something we want to take very lightly, I can guarantee it. So it's a big issue. It really is.
585 West is the number to join the conversation, 585-9378. Let's take a call from Bob joining us in Salt Lake. Bob, welcome.
Yes, thank you.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment on that conversation about conservation. I traveled a bit in Europe. And I don't think most people would consider France a third world country. But staying at a fairly expensive hotel and restaurant in particular, all of the light switches were on timers. And we were told with no uncertain terms that if you're not in the room, you turn the lights out. My wife works for a fairly large company here in town, and they have a policy to leave the lights on at night because it makes the it gives the company a bigger presence. And I think they're I think what we're getting is exactly what we're asking for. You know, as a society, we want to have it all. We want to have it cheap. And I think as long as we get it all and we get it cheap, then nothing is going to change.
Bob, glad you called. Thanks a lot. 585 West, the number, 585-9378. An email from Mark in Spanish Fork who writes, I'm not excited about the abysmal air quality here in Utah. I would invite the gentleman from Florida, I guess he was referring to Joe Lucas before, to visit us during one of our inversions and take a deep breath. However, we have a voracious appetite for energy, Mark writes. So if we're going to replace coal, we're going to have to find an alternative that is as energy dense as coal but not as odious and also is renewable. Not sure anything like this actually exists. 585 West, the number, 585-9378, our email address, radio west@kuer.org. I want to get to the question of political will, local political will, in terms of dealing with the question and addressing the moratorium suggestion, for example. Earlier today, we spoke with, and I'm going to play just an excerpt from this conversation, but we spoke with Dr. Laura Nelson, Governor John Huntsman's energy advisor. Dr. Nelson was talking about the realities of coal in Utah. She mentioned the fact that nearly 95% of the state is powered by coal. So she said that's a reality the state has to deal with. Therefore, they're going to have to find new technology to work around that reality. Here's Dr. Laura Nelson with Governor John Huntsman.
We're working with our utility, which I think we're very fortunate to have, a utility that provides 83% of the power in this state, which is Rocky Mountain Power, which is a Mid-American holding company that's quite progressive on this issue. I don't know if you're aware that with the upgrades that they're doing on their facilities in Utah, that Utah will probably have the cleanest plants in existence. Mm. When we look at new coal, we're looking at things like integrated gasification, combined cycle, and opportunities for carbon capture and sequestration. So we're really looking at, as we look to utilizing coal, how can we get the cleanest coal possible? We also have the Utah Clean Coal Center in the state, which is working on development of technologies. So I think we have to understand what does exactly moratorium mean. I think their proposal is no new coal.
Yeah.
Given that coal is such a vital resource to the state and really to the nation in terms of providing affordable, reliable power, that what we really have to do is look at how can we get the best technologies deployed faster so that we have clean coal both in terms of new resources and also in terms of existing resources.
So it seems like the governor is saying and other state leaders that, look, coal is, like it or not, an economic, well, just a sheer reality in this state. And so the way you deal with the health concerns is, as you're saying, you try to mitigate them. And you're saying the technology exists to do just that.
It does. And we're, you know, like I said, also, we're working with our utility and I should also mention our municipals and our co-ops as well, who we do have the Intermountain Power Project, and they are looking to construct a new facility, which you're probably aware of, and it's been permitted. And I have to praise them for really looking for what is the cleanest, best technology that we can employ, and then how can we do even better than that. So it isn't coal in the old sense. I also want to note that, you know, a big part of what we have to look at is the transportation sector as well, which I'm sure that you're aware of.
Sure.
So it's real easy to kind of point to coal and say, no more coal. But we have to really look, I think, at the full spectrum of what we utilize in terms of our energy resources.
That was Dr. Laura Nelson, Governor John Huntsman's energy advisor. Well, let me get you to react, Brian Mensch and Tim Wagner, particularly. They're dealing with what they say is a reality that technology will be able to help things, but not much hope. It doesn't sound from their perspective on something like a moratorium. Brian Mensch?
Well, you'll notice that the phrase that she used was, we're looking at new technology. In point of fact, this new IGCC technology, integrated gasification combined cycle, is a process that it still is a question mark as to whether or not it will work. There are only two plants in the country that are operating with this technology, and it's not clear that it'll work in Utah. And one of the reasons why is that Utah coal is a little different than Eastern coal. It's less mature. It has a higher water content and a lower heat value. And with this altitude, the partial pressure of oxygen is less, and so the combustion process is less efficient. For all these reasons, it's not clear at all that IGCC technology will work in the state of Utah.
Tim, how are you responding to that? I mean, it doesn't sound like you could get much hope from what she had to say in terms of your hopes, I guess, for a moratorium.
Well, I applaud Dr. Nelson and the governor for at least really taking some serious considerations about these cleaner technologies. The fact remains that none of the four plants that are being proposed in the state are designed or permitted or will be permitted to be using this type of technology, at least not at the present time. The other factor that comes into play is the fact the cost. I mean, when we're talking about an IGCC facility along with carbon capture and sequestration, which is still a long ways out before actually being developed and really do we know that it actually works, it's going to be tremendously costly to do that. And those costs are going to be passed on directly to us, the ratepayer. We already have the technologies in line, wind, solar, geothermal, and biomass technologies from landfill gas projects that are very competitive with coal, if not even cheaper, without these externalities. We need to be putting the resources into these new technologies now, considering Utah gets less than 0.1% of its electricity from renewables. We have a tremendous opportunity here. Let's go for it. Let's do it. Instead of just going on a pipe dream and saying, well, we can continue to use this black rock.
Dr. Mange?
Well, we should look and see what's happening right next door in Colorado. The public utility right next door to us, Xcel Energy, has protested a directive from their PSC to build a new coal power plant because they say that it will be more expensive for the residents of Colorado to build a coal power plant to generate their electricity, and the difference is substantial. They're saying that it will cost the residents of Colorado between $169 and $236 million more to get the same amount of energy from coal that they can get from wind with natural gas backup.
And let me ask Jonah Owen Lamb, who's with us, a staff writer for the Salt Lake City Weekly, finally, your sense of the Sevier County question and the plant that's proposed there, is that settled, or the people who are fighting it, do you think they have much of a chance? Any idea?
I guess it depends on who you talk to. I mean, I talked to Jim Cannon, and he's the president of the Sevier County Citizens for Clean Air and Water, and he says last time I talked to him, it seems like the plant's going to go ahead. You know, another county commissioner I spoke to said, who supports the plant, said, you know, we're still looking into the possibility. So, you know, except for the challenge the Sierra Club is making, there's not really any other challenges being made. And I think the important thing to point out here is that there's regulatory loops in certain kinds of power plants. I believe IPP, also the Sevier plant, are both wholesale plants, which basically makes it so that the PSC of Utah, which regulates most of the plants that are built here, don't really get a say in the building or the siting of these plants. And it's federal regulations that go over with these new plants. And so basically, local governments are the ones that have to deal with a lot of these issues.
Jonah Owen Lamb, he's a staff writer with the Salt Lake City Weekly. He wrote Killer Coal for the May 3rd issue. You can go online. We'll put a link so you can read that story. Jonah, thanks very much for being with us. Dr. Brian Mensch with the Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment. Doctor, thanks very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Tim Wagner, director of the Utah Smart Energy Campaign for the Utah Sierra Club. Thanks very much to you.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.